they have it laying on the table, and I'll just play around with it and move the pieces around and just sort of have fun trying to find pieces that match. And sometimes I think, well, I'm really going to go at it this time. I'm going to get all those nice little pieces with the straight lines on them, and I'm going to put them on a nice pile. And then I'm going to take all the green ones and I'm going to put them in another pile, and all the blue ones and the yellow ones, and I'll get them all sorted out. And then I'll start putting together those nice ones with the straight lines on the outside. Then I start getting frustrated because I'm not very good at this. And I start trying to think of a different way to do it. And I find a piece that has something special on it, that looks like it's one of the most important parts of the puzzle. And I think this is the key piece. Once I get all the rest of the pieces to fit with this key piece, everything will just flow out nicely from this one piece. And I pick up another piece that has that same piece on it, and it fits, but the colors don't match. And I pick up another one. The colors match a little bit, but the piece doesn't fit. And by now I'm getting pretty frustrated, and I'm starting to question my own abilities and wondering why I wanted to do this to begin with. And maybe just, is it really all that important whether I can put a puzzle together or not? And then I start thinking, well, maybe the manufacturer didn't do a good job of punching this one puzzle out. Have you ever done that? And you think, well, it's just not punched out quite right, and so if I just take my two fingers and squeeze it together, it'll fit, and this is the right two pieces together. I've never gotten this far yet. But, you know, this never happens on these puzzles. Have you ever noticed that? Most of you have little children. These are a cinch. I never get frustrated. I never start feeling bad about my own abilities on these puzzles. And never get mad at the manufacturer either. He did a pretty good job on these. But that's sort of what life is like. You know, the easy puzzle pieces, they fit together wonderfully and we don't have any problems. But it's the hard puzzle pieces, the hard parts of life, that we get frustrated and we start feeling bad about ourselves and start feeling like we don't have the right abilities or we're trying to do the right, wrong job. The seminary has been one of those hard puzzle pieces. I know I've questioned a lot of times, am I supposed to be here? What kind of pastor's wife am I going to be anyway? Maybe the seminary should do something more for me. What about all those people back home? Don't they care? And that's some of the questions we'll be asking ourselves as we look at our role in the church. Am I supposed to be a Sunday school teacher? Or am I supposed to be the organist? Or the church secretary? And we'll start asking those same questions. When am I supposed to be? What am I good at? What do other people think that I should be? And tonight, we're very fortunate to have these lovely ladies here to help us sort that out. Bible passage that's always been special to me that I think helps me through these times is Psalm 139. O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. We're something special, and you're the only one of your kind. God gave you a body and a strong, healthy mind. He has a special purpose that he wanted you to find. So he made you something special. You're the only one of your kind. We have two special ladies here that are going to share with us and help us open our night with song tonight. Susie and Joanne.
There may be only two or three left over on the table, I don't know, but look at your neighbors and hopefully they have one with the insert in it. We'd like for you to sing on the third stanza, if you'll all remember to sing along.
Thank you very much. That was nice. There has been work done already in the Synod to find out a little bit more of what the role of women is in the church at this time and maybe some ways that women can be involved in the future. And so I'd like at this time to ask Dr. Jean Garten to share with us a little bit about what the President's Commission on Women is all about, or was all about, I should say, and a little bit of what they'd like to see happen in the future.
Oh, you promised a warm welcome, Harriet, and you delivered. It's great to be here. Candace and I came in this morning from the foreign mission field of New Jersey, and we're just kind of drying out and thawing out, so your heat has really been nice for us today, and we're really delighted to be here, and especially pleased to be here on this day when, after almost 3 years, we have finally moved the Woman's Commission report off our desks. Oh, and it is in process and should be in hand by the end of this month. And that report, together with a Bible study that will be mailed out to all of the congregations, is unique for many reasons, but one is that we wrote it ourselves, wrote both of those ourselves. Most materials that come out of departments or committees are written by staff people. But there were 9 of us who said, let's do it, and that's why it has taken us not only a bit longer, but why we're so relieved today, and tonight being with you is kind of our celebration, our coming out party from under all those stacks of papers. So we're delighted to be here with you. A number of people have commented on what it is we were about. What are you going to say? How have you interpreted Paul's texts? And interestingly enough, we were not an answer commission. We were a study commission, an asking commission rather than an answering commission. And so we decided to open our report with the following true story that happened to one of us, to kind of set the stage for what follows in that report and to give the church an idea of what it is we wanted to do. Have you ever attended a chapel service at the International Center? That's always been a highlight of one of my trips to St. Louis. 12 noon each day signals a time when the papers are set aside, when individuals hidden all morning emerge from their privacy, and when men and women, officers and staff, come together as a family to praise God. I almost missed those special minutes recently when a pastor and I, engrossed in discussion, suddenly heard the silence around us and realized that others had left for chapel. Hurrying to catch up, we found the service already underway and most seats filled. Spotting a few empty ones off to the side, I headed in that direction, pleased that my new pastor friend was joining me. The chapel is a beautiful place for worship, despite the constant movement beyond its multi-storied glass walls. Wherever you sit, you can see the altar, and at the same time, the world speeding by on busy superhighways which crisscross and intertwine like a complex roller coaster. Depending on where you sit, you can see trailer tractors laboring up an incline or quickening down a hill, or see cars leaving or entering an access road. The worshiper can see traffic lights or not, pedestrians or not, joggers or not. What you see or don't see depends on where you sit. Thus it was that after the service, the pastor said to a friend sitting nearby, "Did you see what happened when we came in? I followed a woman and look where I ended up. In all of my previous visits here, I never sat on this side of the chapel. And you know what? I had a whole different view and saw things I've never seen before." The report which follows is, in a sense, an invitation to see what the Women's Commission has seen during its months of study. It's an opportunity to sit where women sit and to view the church from our perspective. It is also an attempt to highlight the varied ministries of women in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and the joys we have as women in the service of the Triune God. That's how it begins. And as we work through the process, there were 9 of us involved, all from 9 different districts of Synod. But, interestingly enough, now, as we tally up, there are 5 of us who are MWs. One, the wife of a chaplain. One, newly the wife of a pastor. And the rest of us who are ministers' wives, wives of pastors in different kinds of ministries, but of the nine, there are five of us who have a particular interest in the ministry that you're going to be serving in. We were assigned by the president six tasks. Previous committees, and there were two previous task forces, were in a sense free to develop their own agenda. We were asked to determine specific information. The first was to discover how many of the recommendations of the Task Force on Women had been implemented. And everybody's so quick to say, nothing ever happens in the church. Well, we found that almost all of the recommendations had been implemented in Synod. Secondly, we were asked to gather data, and we involved ourselves in a major Synod-wide survey, very reliable, representative survey of the people of the Synod. And perhaps in the question and answer session, you might want to know something about that. Candace has a specialty in that area because she was responsible for the committee that worked on that. Thirdly, we were asked by the president to explore the emphases, the current emphases of the women's movement, and determine what effect, if any, those have had on the church. And that was an interesting assignment because the women's movement has changed so much in recent years, and it is now moving into a new phase, a phase that is putting more emphasis on the family, strengthening the family. And that's certainly something we all in the country can resonate to. But there's been the perception that changes in the church or interests of women in increasing their service is directly related to the woman's issue or the woman's movement. In a sense, that's partially true. But many other things have been happening in society. As we studied the women's movement, we realize that the economy has played a part in how women are living their lives today, and the focus on individualism has played a part, and so on. So this was a particularly interesting study for us. Fourth, we were asked by the president to consult with the CTCR, the Commission on Theology and Church Relations, as it developed its document on women in the church. And that was, to the best of our knowledge, the first time there was a collegial relationship between two commissions of the Synod, and certainly the first time that women of the church had a chance to interact on a fairly ongoing way with that important commission. There were a number of things we talked to those men about as they were preparing that document. One I'll mention, and there were others, but one we were particularly pleased about. As we read through the material, it focused on what Scripture said relating to women in the Old Testament and how women served then. And then it talked about what Paul said about women and how women served in New Testament times. But we felt there was a gap there that involved what Jesus said, how Jesus related to women. On the previous task force, we had studied the Gospels and identified every instance where Christ talked to a woman, performed a miracle on a woman, taught a woman, used a woman as an example in a parable or a story, an anecdote. And the picture that emerged of the view Christ had of women was just so joyful. And we said to the men on the commission, please include that section in the document. And they did, and it's really an exciting portion of their report, if you have a minute to take a look at that. A fifth assignment was to explore the possibility of establishing a network of districts commissions on women, doing what we do on a national level on the district level. It's not to create a new organization, but rather to identify ministries of women within a district that can be replicated. We found women in congregations or as individuals doing the most creative kinds of things. But without some kind of network, no one knows about them and there's no sharing. One congregation has focused on mothers, and they have an ongoing program just for mothers. Problems that relate to child rearing and discipline, or problems that relate to women health-wise. That's the kind of program that already has a model that can easily be adapted for congregations. And a network would help us share that kind of information. And then sixth, the president asked us to determine the service of women currently and make recommendations for increase service of women at all areas. And I'd like to get into not the recommendations, but what led to the recommendations. I want to mention one recommendation, however, that has to do with the wives of ministers. One of the things we discovered on our survey was that the majority of the respondents felt it was acceptable for ministers' wives to be employed. But one-fourth of those who responded didn't think it was very wise for a woman to work within the congregation where her husband had been called for pay. About one in five said that the pastor's wife should assume an above-average amount of responsibility for congregational activities. Think about that. One in five, the perception is that they all expect us to be Mrs. Super, minister's wife. That's not what the survey showed. There has been a shift in attitude about what is expected about MWs. We met with groups of minister's wives at a district level or in circuit groups, and we found that there was a desire on the part of some pastors for a recognition of the status of their wives. It appears in the Eastern Orthodox religion, the minister's wife has a label, a title, and is recognized in a special way. Some of these pastors said, couldn't we have that for our wives who are so much a part of our ministry? Some pastors felt that ministers' wives were treated by seminaries and congregations as second-class citizens. And some expressed resentment that wives, in some instances, are critiqued by bishops during the vicarage year. Both pastors and wives expressed disappointment that most lectures given wives prior to seminary graduation were given by men, and by men long out of parish ministry. Now, most of those women had been out of seminary for a few years, and perhaps that has changed. That was a repeated appeal that somehow women in the seminary with their husbands be trained, as Scripture says, by older women. The older women should teach the younger. And then, you know, there's that long list in Titus. And ministers' wives, in general, commented about the joy they had. And many saw themselves as having been called by God to serve him in a unique way. But another recurring theme in every session we had with ministers' wives was the difficulty they had in retaining their own identity. And there was an appeal for schools and the synod to help them be prepared for that time when they went out into the parish. It's a great stress that they mentioned over and over. So these are our questions to the synod. Could seminaries continue to prepare ministers' wives for their role in congregations through increased counsel provided by experienced ministers' wives in keeping with the biblical concept that older women should teach the younger. Could seminaries develop a more formalized series of lectures and programs for ministers' wives which would address the problems experienced by many in the parish, such as isolation, loneliness, identity as an individual, congregational expectations, burnout, etc.? And could ministers' wives, if desired, be recognized in some way as having a calling and a ministry of their own? So even in our recommendations, we did not say, this is what you should do. We rather, again, ask the question, being consistent with our asking role. As we prepared for the recommendations, we identified a variety of themes that were repeated over and over in all of our listening sessions. I'm just going to run through them very quickly for you. General concerns were an opportunity for service is limited. Two, there are inconsistencies in practice. Now, I'd love to give you some examples, but I'm looking at the time. There's a confusion, three, from the seeming change of mind by the church. Four, assumptions exist which need to be examined. And we identified those. Five, the whole question of what gives offense, what is giving offense. And sixth is the financial stewardship of women now as money producers, money contributors, and their attitude about giving money without being able to give service. It's an interesting question. But let me go down the joys. Joy, as women in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, because we're confident that we are fully members of the priesthood of all believers, that we're in a church that affirms the vocation of mothers and wives, that we are a church that has an opportunity for women to be church professionals. Fourth, a church that has opportunities for important, vital service, regardless of education or age. We're in a church with a high regard for education and with a mission to the least. We're in a church committed to Bible study. And the eighth, joy that we're in a confessional church. We concluded our report with some of these comments, but they're just a few. We find now that we have completed our task that we are different women than when we began. We've discovered an even greater joy in being women and have a greater understanding of the implications of being created by God as a helper for His purpose and for His pleasure. Much of that heightened awareness came from our study of the Magnificat. Mary, in her servanthood, exhibited the strength of femininity, which is responsiveness. It was her weakness and powerlessness that made her a suitable receptacle for God's use. And by responding, she exemplified the strength through weakness demonstrated by Christ Himself. Luther, in his commentary on the Magnificat, wrote that Mary, by her word and example, teaches us to know about God. But the Magnificat is not about Mary. It's about the God who came for Mary, from Mary, and to be a helper to Mary. Mary's child and Mary's God are one. As she holds him in her arms, in truth, it is he who holds her. Amazing! The first man, Adam, was created by the power of God without a woman. But the second Adam, Jesus, came to earth by the power of God without a man. In God's plan to send his son, he graciously willed to need a woman. God chose to need a woman to sustain his human life, to give him a human birth, to be nurtured and trained by her during his years of childhood. In God's plan for the world, he needs women in much the same way in every generation. He needs women today especially who will reflect him as the God who responds to human needs with self-sacrifice and compassion. He needs women who will witness to his regard for those held in low regard by society. And he needs women who see a dignity and not a denigration in serving others, in being what we have been created to be, a helper. And no man can do that in quite the way a woman can. And no one has more opportunity to do that than a minister's wife. We have time now for questions. I think we can go until 7:50. Questions or comments? Louise and Candace, why don't you come up here? Louise is chairman of our Bible study committee. So if you have any questions about that, which we've called the There for a Woman, Louise can answer that, or anything you want to ask about what we've done or will be doing or where we are now, way in the back. Yes, we had two single women on the commission. We have addressed the single woman in our Bible study and in a number of questions that has been addressed. Again, there, as you've probably seen, there are a number of materials that Synod has put out on the single woman. Tomorrow, Candace and I will be participating in a meeting of the task force on ministries to families. And on that task force, the specific needs of singles and divorced people and so on will be addressed. So we, again, we're not an answer commission, but simply attempting to identify areas that the church could address.
Between nights with a little soup and a sandwich and nothing at all.
Yes, my goodness. Wake up, everybody. Way in the back.
Me? I talked to managers of grocery stores, bakeries this year.
We were, yes, no. Isn't that a wonderful answer? Very clear. We completed this set of assignments at the Synodical Convention. We did our last data gathering there. President has decided to continue the task force on the commission on women until the next Synodical Convention. However, with a little reshaping, he carried over 4 of the original 9 members and added 2 more to bring in other representation. He was very diligent about having certain kinds of women represented on the last commission, a crit teacher, for instance, a member of the LWML, and we had the president of the LWML serving. I want to tell you about our official name is the President's Commission on Women, and you know the propensity in our church for shortening everything using acronyms so that we're in the LCMS and we belong to the LWML while our husbands are in the LLL and we studied with the CTCR, and you know, you get so bogged down. So here we were with this long title, President's Commission on Women, and so we called ourselves the PCW. However, a number of people shortened it even further and they called us the Commission on Women, and when you take the first letters of that, you know what you get. And somehow that didn't seem very professional to see us referred to as the cow. So we would see that in reports and in district supplements, and I'd sit and write a nice, gentle little note and say, we are not the COW, we are the PCW. I don't know, I don't think the mail goes out of New Jersey because we never got any response. So we decided if you can't beat 'em, join 'em. So we had buttons made that say, "Holy cow!" Holy cow, for those of you in the back. So now we'll have to put holy cow too. No, but we have some proposals of how to get at that. The district network is one of those. We believe we can really get down to the congregational level and to meet the needs of women in different districts. Those, for instance, in Iowa with the farm crisis have different needs than we do on the East Coast, where there are no Missouri Synod churches. You know, we're miles and miles apart, so the isolation for us on the coast is different. The task force tomorrow that Candace and I will be serving on, that's the first meeting on Task Force on the Family, and that's going to be a responsibility of ours to plug in those areas of need that we have identified so that programs and helps and resources can be developed to address some of those questions. Did you want to respond, Jenny? Just give a yell if you want to add.
Well, one thought that came to my mind, is this on? Can you hear me? And now I can't see you, but is if you take a look at the report, when it is done, read through it yourself, and then begin to think about some men and women in your new parish or where you're at right now, and sit down and work through it yourself and plan your own strategy, if you will, not only in your own parish, but then at the circuit level and the district level. And one other approach that you might find in the report will be the statistics section, in the sense that the questions that were asked, the data that was gathered, you might consider doing some mini surveys of your own in using some of those questions and comparing it and using that as a takeoff for discussion and listening and exploration together. And if you really wanted to go the whole nine yards, you could get a copy of the actual questionnaire that was used to collect the attitude and distribute it and use it. That would be something that would be available through the President's Commission on Women and is available. So those are just some ideas of ways that you could begin to take this report and apply it personally and in your own local parish.
Oui.
But one of the things that the Commission on Women did was to prepare a Bible study that is also coming out with our report. And we did this a little bit differently. We have Bible studies for the different situations women find themselves in. We have a Bible study for single women. We have a Bible study for single again. That's quite different, you know, than not being married at all, the widows and the divorced. We have a Bible study for mothers, for wives, for older women, that's the category I fit in, and
for yuppies,
the yuppies,
us, yes, young
yeah,
kids.
Okay, go ahead. And I think that maybe there'll be quite a bit of direction there for you as you study those through, because it's kind of trying to get to women where they are and what they're thinking, and then point them to what Christ says about their situation.
The comment is, this woman has been in two districts where there has been a very active group of women, and they could get together as a core group, and that's been so supportive. But both of those districts are the solid districts in our synod, you know, in terms of numbers, and that's Michigan and Minnesota. Out in New Jersey, that just doesn't happen, and in, you know, some places. And that's the kind of model, you know, that this next go-around we hope we can identify so that other, like women like you, who will go out and seed the synod, could develop. Okay, the report and Bible study will be mailed to every congregation. At this point, there will be a few copies available. we're hoping at this moment, the plan is to make a copy of each available to every fourth year seminary student. So many of you will be getting those before you go out. There will be extra copies. Again, at this point, that's how it looks. There will be extra copies of the Bible study that you will be able to get. There will be a limited number of extra copies of the report. We've asked in the Bible study to have a variety of people use it, not just women, because we feel it will help the whole church to better understand some of the pressures women are under in their different roles. I know the perception probably is that, you know, here's this woman, this outgoing type A kind of personality, and I really am not. When I'm not on, you can hardly get me to say too much. I'm one of those people in small groups. I don't know what to talk about. I don't know how to make small talk. And I want you to know that about me, because I suspect there are a number of you sitting out there who are also shy people, who will find that when the Lord provides an opportunity, He also provides the courage to do what He has called you to do. One of the questions Harriet asked us to consider was, why did we choose to do what we are doing? And I have to tell you, I never did choose to do anything. I have never had an ambition to be something or someone. And in this day and age, I know the attitude is different. I've spent a lot of time with Candace, who has led a very prominent life in Washington, and is part of the generation that identifies women as mentors, model themselves after that mentor, learn from her, and have goals and strategies. And my mind just doesn't work that way. What I'm doing came out of either an interest I had or a need that existed, never intending to go beyond what I was doing. My career in the church that changed from being a Sunday school teacher, VBS teacher, you know, in the LWML, that brought me to where I am today doing synodical work, began with a little Bible study in our congregation. And it happened to be a Bible study on a topic that was of interest to me. Nobody else even wanted to hear about it. But I was excited about doing it, and that began. It was contagious. Other people said, oh, you've got to do that for our husbands. And so that's how it all began. I see myself today and in these last, what are now 18 years, as a resource person. My training was in teaching, and so gathering information and sharing it came as a natural to me. And because I had so many interests, and because pastors and teachers have so little time, I've been able to fill in some of those gaps. And I talk about astrology or the Dead Sea Scrolls or abortion or women's issues or family issues. And that's how I see myself, not teaching pastors, not usurping authority, but providing for them in a quick seminar or lecture a whole lot of information that would take them many, many weeks to dig out. My life is, as a teacher, as some of you are, you're always thinking of how you can use something in your teaching. I walk through life every day. How can I use that incident in a teaching setting to make the gospel clearer? And so my life has become one big act of translating everyday incidents into some kind of biblical insight. And a number of people have said, we think of you as the Irma Bombeck of the Missouri Synod. And don't take that wrong. I think that's a great compliment because I love Irma Bombeck, and she takes the everyday things of life, and, you know, we all can identify with it. And in a sense, that's what I do in the area of spiritual things. So I'm always looking for people to share with. And I guess that's another way I see myself. A number of people have said they feel sorry for my family. They said, we love what you're doing. Oh, we're so glad you're doing that. And then in the next breath, we feel so sorry for her kids and her husband. Don't feel sorry. Send cookies. That's one thing, baking, that just simply hasn't gotten done in the last 18 years. You have to be with an oven to do it, and they don't provide those on a plane. And so so I have had a concern that people have the perception that my family is really neglected. My family is very old now. I did not start traveling or being involved beyond the parish until I was 42. My children were fairly well along. My oldest daughter is going on 33. Has four children. So, I mean, you want to feel sorry for anybody, feel sorry for her. Three of those are triplets. But we've had to deal with this involvement I have, which, in a sense, puts me in a bigger swimming pool than my husband's. I have a wonderfully secure husband who isn't threatened by being called Reverend Jean Garten or Jean Garten's white husband.
Yeah.
But we talked about how I could serve in full-time ministry as a volunteer, which is what I am. I'm not on anybody's staff. I don't get any salary, but I do, for the same reason you do. And we adopted a missionary model. You know how we really affirm men and women who pull up stakes, cross an ocean, and take their children away from family and support system back here. And we say, they've done that in service to the Lord. And then beyond that, when they get in the mission field, often they send their children away to the mission school and don't see them for weeks or months. We say, that's a good thing in that. That's a sacrifice in service to the Lord. It was that model we adopted, but we didn't cross an ocean to do it. My children have known that it would require some adjustment in our lives as mom became, in a sense, a circuit rider. And so we viewed what I've done as being an itinerant speaker going around the country. If I had anything to say to those of you who are going out, it would be this. First, the image of the minister's wife will kill you. That image, trying to live up to the expectations of this woman, that board, this commission, this congregation, will kill you. Know who you are so that you don't try to remake yourself into something people think you should be. And secondly, develop those abilities that God has given you. I know everybody expects the minister's wife to be in the kitchen for suppers. I'd poison the congregation. The last place you'd want me is in the kitchen. And that's not an ability of mine, and it's not an interest of mine. So I've developed those skills, and my congregation at first thought, what is this we have? And now they have become very supportive because they realize that I'm using talents God gave me. And they're different than theirs. Not better, just different. Thirdly, I would remind you that being in the parish is very hard work. I've been the wife of five different men
a public school teacher, a traveling salesman, a business executive, and on, but the most difficult role I've ever had is being a minister's wife. Yet at the same time, it's the most joyful one, because here is a whole group of people who love me and accept me just because I had the good sense to marry that man. But it requires perspective and patience. And then finally, I believe a minister's wife has power to make a difference, a real difference in the lives of people. I'm, when all is said and done, just a minister's wife, ministering to people in pews just as you will do. Just happens that the pews I deal with are in every state in the union, but people are the same. So, while I've been all different kinds of wives, and being a minister's wife has been the most difficult, it is by far the one that has given me most joy and more blessings than anything else I've ever done. And I wish you all well as you embark on a life that's going to be filled with surprises.
Candace, you have this distinctive honor, I guess, of not being the wife of a pastor, but I'd like for you to share with us, if you would, a little bit about your involvement in the church and what it's been.
I was thinking about that, too, that I'm kind of distinct in not being a minister's wife, being married to a man who has been involved in government relations work, as I have, for 11 years. And so I should lobby you, right? And I'm going to. But it's not going to be really a description of what a lobbyist is, but rather I want to talk to you as one of the roles that I served on the President's Commission on Women, and which I have served, I think, in other ways as well, and that's as being a yuppie Christian woman. Okay, how many of you are yuppies? How many of you are young? Okay. How many of you are urban? Urban, St. Louis, urban. All right, every hand goes up. All right. I know some of you are just visiting, but it's urban. How many of you are pros? Y-U-P, yuppie. You're all yuppies. Okay. I'm a yuppie, and I'm proud of it. And what I want to talk to you tonight about is lobby you a little bit, and that is to look out for the yuppies in your parishes. And I want to share with you, very briefly, how some pastors' wives have had an impact on my life. And yes, I'm still a yuppie, but I'm a Lutheran Christian yuppie, I hope. Up until January, my husband and I lived in Washington, D.C. We now live in Trenton, New Jersey. We lived and worked in downtown Washington, D.C., and there are three people in this room who have been in our apartment in Washington and saw our bohemian lifestyle. I came to D.C. from Illinois, grew up on a farm, born, baptized, confirmed in a Missouri Synod parish, where the pastor's wife called my pastor, Pastor. Not John, but Pastor. But what she shared with me as I was a child in that role that she served with my Pastor Stubbe was that she really respected him, loved what he did, and it showed. And it was a grandmotherly kind of role for me as a young child with Mrs. Stubbe. Well, went to college, moved to Washington, D.C., to be involved in public policy. And for 6 or 7 years, I worked hard. You might even say I was a workaholic. And during that time, my husband and I worshipped at an urban Lutheran church. It was Lutheran Church of America. Work was really my idol. I was being a yuppie. My hard work translated into money, a little bit of power, and being a young married woman, I was also very interested in sex. And those are the yuppies' goals: money, sex, and power. But, thank the Lord, because of my work, I met a woman who was pro-life, involved in family issues, was active in Washington activities, and she took time with a younger Missouri Synod sister. And during the course of the years of the time that she took, we've learned much from each other. And she was a Missouri Synod pastor's wife. So Jean, in many ways, mentored me. She put me in touch with some of the social ministry activities of the church, and I got hooked. I was back in. I began to like Missouri. And as an adult, it was even better than as a child in a farm community in Illinois. Through the course of events, Dr. Bowman asked if I would consider serving as a consultant on government relations issues and establishing a Washington office for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And as I started off this exciting challenge of service, I was really helped tremendously by my pastor's wife. And by now, David and I had returned to the fold and were worshiping at Missouri Synod Parish in Bethesda, Maryland. And my pastor's wife there was co-leading a weekly Bible study that I was attending. And, you know, just one of those one-minute kind of opportunities to share that has meant so much to me since that time. She was talking about baptism. And she said, "You know how I remember my baptism? Every morning when I jump into the shower, I think about my baptism. And I know that day to day, through my repentance, I'm reborn and I can go on with my day." Now, her husband, my pastor, was co-leading this Bible study, and I just couldn't have imagined pastor getting up and saying, "You know how I think of my baptism when I'm in the shower." But Sylvia, my pastor's wife, shared that. And starting off on my new assignment, it was such a wonderful way to start each morning. And so different, starting from a spirit of repentance, salvation, and then a commitment to service as I began each day preparing the way for the development of the Washington office for our church body. So Sylvia taught me some helpful hints about Christian living that were very Lutheran. Now I've moved to Trenton, New Jersey, and my pastor's wife and I are together once a week early in the morning in a Bible study and prayer group. And although it's still been such a short time, I feel as though I have a new friend, a peer. Kay is a working wife and mother, and she's helping me now, as a peer, look to new chapters in my life. So, grandmother, mentor, teacher, peer, friend. Many different roles that pastors' wives have played for me, this yuppie woman. But they all had one thing in common, and that was that they loved being Lutheran Christians, and as a side benefit for me as a woman, they were women. But they loved being Lutheran Christians. So, I just want to leave you with a lobbying thought, and that is, if there are young people in your parish or daughters and sons of parishioners who sometimes are in church, sometimes aren't, are involved in that agnostic kind of, you know, the world, I've got it by the tail period of their life. Maybe you could reach out to them. Maybe you could, in some little moment, be there to tell them what to do when they're in the shower in the morning. So do think about that, and I pray that you will have an impact on some young people, some yuppies who can be Christians. And if you do get to talking with them, here comes the advertisement, pull out the Yuppie Bible Study in the President Commission's report and invite them over for a beer or a white wine or a Perrier and go through the Bible study. So thank you.
Thank you, Candace. Our next panelist is Louise Miller. And Louise, I hope you noticed on the back table over there, we have the Lutheran Women's Quarterly out. So all of you, be sure you pick it up as you leave. Louise is the editor-in-chief of the Lutheran Women's Quarterly. And so she was also on the Women's Task Force, and also on the President's Commission on Women. So if you'd share with us.
Well, first of all, can you hear me? Because my voice doesn't carry. Okay. First of all, in introducing myself, I am not only an MW, as Jean calls it, I am also a PK. How many of you know what a PK is? I grew up in a Lutheran parsonage, and I loved it. We always lived right next door to the church. Every time there was a dinner or anything going on at the church, half of my mother's dishes and silverware ended up at the church. And I don't know, I must have had very wonderful parents because we thought it was fun. And I really thought that was my ambition. I wanted to be a pastor's wife. And when I married a pastor, I just assumed that I would spend the rest of my life in a parish, perhaps doing what my mother did. But we were in a parish a little over 3.5 years, and my husband went into chaplaincy services, and it's been a very different kind of life for me. And I've really been a very great many years away from being a parish pastor's wife. I've known a great many of them, but there is a little bit of a difference, and I think maybe some of the opportunities that I have had might not have happened had we stayed in a parish. I don't know. I do know that the Lord has really opened some things to me that I never thought were possible. I would say I found out what I liked to do when I was almost too old to do it. But He has really challenged me and pushed me, and I never looked for anything either. I walked into the LWML office about 20 years ago, I guess it was, and applied for the job as headquarters office manager. And I was trying to put kids through college. Pastor's salary doesn't extend that far, you know, so I was trying to put kids through college. And that was my door. You will have other doors, I'm sure. One thing led to another, and I did some writing, and now that I'm completely retired, I'm editing the Lutheran Woman's Quarterly, and I have found out that I just love layout and I love editing. So I found out what I like to do after I retired. But I've met a great many pastors' wives, and I've met women that work, and I've met women that don't work. I've met women that are very involved in their husband's ministry to where it's almost a partnership, and I've met some who are very quiet and who are not a part of that ministry at all. I've met outgoing women, and I've met quiet women. And very great many of them, I can say they were great pastors' wives, even though they were very, very different. And then I have stopped to think about what makes a good pastor's wife. What really is a good pastor's wife? And the more I've thought about it, the more I've come to the conclusion that the women that I have observed in the various churches that I have been in a lot of them would make very good pastors' wives because they're involved in their church. And I think that any woman who is a good lay member would make a very good pastor's wife. That's really what we are, isn't it? We're members of our parishes, and we're lay members of our parishes. We're not professional people. Our husband is a professional. Even in a team ministry, it's good to remember that, isn't it? And in talking about the priorities that you set as a pastor's wife, I guess I see three of them, and I'm putting them in an order that I think is rather important. Your first priority is yourself as a person and your relationship to your Savior. That's first. I like to look at Ephesians when I think about that. There's some very beautiful passages in Ephesians about who you are as a person. And I like this in the Living Bible because I think it's so beautiful. In Ephesians, just a minute, I've got it all written down here, so you have to wait a minute. In Ephesians 2:10, there are the words, "We are God's workmanship, created for Him to good works." The original word for workmanship in the Greek can also be translated poetry. Think a little bit about that. We are God's poetry. Then in 1 verse 11, God, the Living Bible says, "We have become gifts of God that He delights in, for we were chosen from the beginning." And in the Living Bible it says, let's see, is that in here? No, this is in farther along. In Ephesians 4, verse 7, "Christ has given each of us special abilities, whatever He wants us to have out of the rich storehouse of His gifts." And in 4 verse 5, "Before He made the world, God chose us to be His own, to adopt us into His family by sending Christ Jesus to die for us. And He did it because He wanted to." That's in the Living Bible, and I think that's tremendous. He did it because He wanted to. So I think the very first priority is that you are a person in a relationship to your Savior, and your Savior thinks you're important. He thinks you're a poem. He thinks you have gifts, and He wants you to use those gifts in His service. Secondly, since you are married, you're a wife, and in some cases, a mother. And you are a wife to your husband, not necessarily to a pastor. You're his wife now before he's a pastor. If he leaves the parish, you will be his wife. And that really is a higher priority. My third priority is that you're the pastor's wife. But that's third. Now think a little bit about those priorities. Because I was thinking about them, I thought to myself, are those good priorities for our husbands too? Just think a little bit about it. Because sometimes I think pastors have a tendency to put number three as number one. And sometimes you maybe have to be the person to remind your husband of that. You know, a lot of pastors' wives complain because their husbands are at meetings every night. And it might be because they don't want to share them, but sometimes I think pastors get so involved in their work that they forget they have families. And they get so involved in their work that they forget that they're first of all responsible to God and not to the congregation. And maybe you need to be the person to remind them of that once in a while. And it's kind of a hard battle to fight, I'll tell you, because it's a little bit like, well, if you got a workaholic husband, who are you fighting? He's serving the Lord, aren't you, isn't he? So you got to think a little bit about that, too. One of the other things that I think is important as pastors' wives, well, a couple of things. One of them is maybe your attitude. I think it's fun to be a pastor's wife. So a lot of people complain because they think they're living in a fishbowl. And in a way, maybe you are. But where else in the world can you get so many babysitters for nothing as you've got in a congregation? Isn't it wonderful? We have seminary students who come to our congregation, and it's just amazing how many people in the congregation have adopted the babies when they have babies. And it's just a little foretaste of what they're going to get when they go out. And I think a positive attitude means an awful lot. As I said, I was raised in a parsonage, so was my husband, and I shouldn't tell tales on my mother-in-law, but I remember one time she said, I long ago resigned myself to being a pastor's wife. And I really resented her saying that. I didn't like that a bit, because I don't think you have to resign yourself to it. I think it's fun. Another thing I think that it's important to remember is that you and your husband both need time together for that relationship with the Lord. It's amazing how often family devotions and couple devotions are neglected in parsonages because pastors get so busy that they don't have time for it. And their wives hate to mention it because they are so busy and it's hard to find a time for it. But it's very important. And it will bring you closer together if you do it. And the third thing I would say, and this is not as a pastor's wife, it's just as a person, and that is that I think the Lord wants us to keep on growing. He says so. He doesn't want us to stay where we are. He wants us to stay open for new ideas. You know, there's a great many chapters in a woman's life. And maybe you can even think of some of the chapters you've already had in your lives. There's the chapter before you were married. There's the chapter when the children are small, and sometimes it seems like that's going to go on forever. But that's over with too, and then they leave home. And then there's a whole life ahead of you yet. For me, it's been about 20 years already of having children away from home. And there's a new challenge and something new the Lord wants you to do. So there's always room to grow, and there's always room to, and that's what the Lord wants you to do. I guess that would be what I have to say to you as future pastor's wife.
Thank you. We also have the distinct honor of having Mrs. Jean Barth with us. Mrs. Barth has had an opportunity to encourage several pastors' wives in her role as being on a district level and in a seminary and, of course, within a parish. And so if you would share with us a little bit about your roles you've had.
If I may, I would like to preface my remarks with a little personal note. I was born and raised in St. Louis, about 6 blocks from the seminary. And I went to public school about 6 blocks from here. It was on Bellevue and Ethel. And then I went to DeMunn School, which is now Captain School, for what they call domestic science, sewing and cooking. And then when I went to Wydown Junior High, I walked by my house that I now live in twice a day, never dreaming that someday I would live in that house. And often terrified of the people that I saw walking down the street, you know, and wondering what kind of people live in those houses. And now I'm one of those people. But I love it. I love it. I just thoroughly enjoy it. And it's a great place to be. I never either thought that someday I might marry a seminarian. That was the farthest thing from my mind. But I did, as you have done. And when you do that, you expect to be a parish pastor's wife for the rest of your life. But many times the Lord shows you that he has other things in mind for you and that he's in control. So in 1970, Dr. Barth was elected president of the South Wisconsin District, where he served for 12 years. Then in 1982, after having lived in Wisconsin 30 years and getting very comfortable, the Lord decided he was going to move us. So he brought us here to St. Louis. And so then he, in a sense, brought me back home again. So the Lord always shows you that he's in charge, that he's in control, and don't get too comfortable. But I think I'll try to point out some of the differences as I see them in these three different roles. I suppose in the parish pastoral ministry, I served the traditional role. We had 5 children. I had a 10-room house. We had a big parish and a big school, and so I had all I could do to take care of the family and the house, try to participate in congregational activities, try to be a part of school activities so I could be supportive of the children and of my husband. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a great parish, and it was the support system that you have in the parish, you don't have any place else, not in any other profession. You know, you laugh with these people and you cry with them, and you pray for them, and you pray with them. And to me, it's the most beautiful thing a person could do in their life, who's worked for the Lord in this capacity. And always remember, the parish pastor is the highest office in the church. There is no higher office than the parish pastor and his wife. We need executives and we need presidents, but you are serving as the pastor's wife and your husband. You have the highest office in the church, and don't ever forget that. But I think even though you are as a parish pastor's wife, you are in the limelight, very much so in the limelight, and your family too. But perhaps not so much. You're not so much in alignment as the president, district president's wife, because you're no longer the first lady of the congregation. You no longer have a flock. You no longer have a congregation. And that's a very empty feeling when all of a sudden you realize you don't have that support system anymore. Not being the wife of a parish pastor, perhaps you have the freedom of choosing how much you would like to participate in the congregational activities. Or maybe it will afford you the freedom of pursuing a hobby. And you very rarely attend your home congregation because your husband is preaching someplace every Sunday, mission festival, anniversary, ordination, installation. And so you very rarely get to your home congregation. And so you feel that tremendous loss of that flock and that support system. And yet maybe you do have some sort of a support system because the district in South Wisconsin, we had 200 congregations, about 300 pastors. And they are, in a sense, I suppose they are your support system. They're always very supportive of you. And we often met with every circuit. So we met every pastor and every pastor's wife. And in that sense, we were able to encourage them as much as we could. Another unique experience was going to call meetings. I always went with Dr. Barth, and sometimes we would have a 2-hour drive to the meeting and home. But that was a very unusual experience and very, let's say, revealing to see the personalities of people and congregations and how they view the ministry. Sometimes I would come home very sad and sometimes very happy. But it was a very enlightening experience, and I'm happy that I had that experience. But again, I say, with all those opportunities, You still and always feel the loss of the congregation and of that support system that you had. As the wife of the seminary president, you were very much in the limelight, and it is altogether different from either of the other two places where we served. You're surrounded every day by your staff people, by your professors and their wives, by the seminarians and their wives, by so many, many people. But they do show you love. We have had so many beautiful notes and letters and cards from seminaries and their wives, and those are a tremendous boost to us. You have no idea how much that means to us to receive those notes, and it's a tremendous encouragement when we do receive them. I guess the biggest part of my role here is entertaining, and that takes tremendous amount of planning and scheduling and rescheduling, and it's an entertaining anywhere from 8 to 400 people, but I love it, and it's entertaining dignitaries from our foreign churches, from other church bodies, from our own church body, Board of Regents, our international students, our student association officers, which we love to do and love to entertain them in our home. Secretary's coffee hours, all of this is, is really the biggest part, I think, of the president's wife's role. At least that's the way I see it here at the seminary. But I say I love it. You know, I thoroughly enjoy it, and I wouldn't give it up for anything. And I don't know why the Lord gave me the privilege of serving here, but it is a privilege, and I do love it, and I do enjoy it, and I have to say that I feel the Lord left the best for last for me. But no matter where you serve or how you serve the Lord, be very supportive of your husband and very encouraging, and by all means have it. Your attitude is so important, and that's really the key to a successful ministry. Your attitude, your support of him, your encouragement. He needs that every day. He needs to hear that every day from you. And ask the Lord to give you the right words to say, and he will. They will be there. And so I pray that God will bless you very richly in your ministry. I'm sure he'll bring you many rich blessings. And again, remember, you have the highest office in the church. God go with you.
Well, I didn't hear any of these ladies come right out and say it, but I kind of sensed at different times and while we were on Vicarage that a pastor's wife also needs to be flexible. So we're going to be a little bit flexible with our schedule tonight. We had publicized and said earlier that we were going to have some small group discussions at the end of the time of the meeting. Well, I think we'll be a little bit flexible here, and I'd like for you to take a time now to pull out your schedule, look at the back, the little program thing you had, and there are on there four questions that I'd like for you, instead of thinking of it as what it says, group discussion questions, in your mind, change it, or with your pencil, change it, and have it said, questions that I'm going to ask myself when I go home. And make those questions that you think about, because they're dealing with the issues that we've talked about here tonight. And I think for the rest of the time that's left, I'm going to open it up and allow people to ask questions of the panelists. And if that's, I hope, acceptable for the panelists, because I didn't forewarn them. And there also may be some things that you may have wished to share, but due to Harriet's little 10-minute time restraint, didn't have a chance to. And what I would want to make a mention, though, with regard to these questions, is that I had a pastor share, I think maybe it was the second year that my husband was here, in one of the classes he shared, that he felt it was very important for a wife to think about what she would want to become involved with or what she might not want to become involved with before she actually went into a parish. And that way, communicate it to her husband, so that the husband could reinforce that with the congregation. And then when the question came up, is your wife going to teach Sunday school or play the organ, that he could say, well, maybe not either one of those is her strong suit, but rather she might have something else in mind, or that she'd just rather watch and see where she would best fit in. So these discussion questions, I'd like for you to think of those as questions you're going to ask yourself, so that you can have those in your mind as you either go on Vicarage, go on a first call, or look forward to a Vicarage or a first call. But at this time, and I would like to try to end our meeting around 9 o'clock, so those of you with children can feel free to go. But I'd like to open it up for any questions or comments from the panelists so that they can you can share a little bit more of any thoughts you had, and they can with you.
Where are you going to be this summer? Are you going to be home in your own places? Are you going to be in your vicarages or with your first call? It might be good to look for it in the congregation there, because it'll be there.
The comment here was, if you send it to the seminary, maybe you ought to put for wives on it, because then maybe we'll get to see it. That was a concern we had, and is one of our recommendations for the church to explore ways for the male of the church, M-A-I-L, to reach women, because so few are in positions in congregations, for instance, as chairing, you know, boards, and those people get the reporter and alive, and some of the church mail. And then pastors get documents. But because of the way women serve in churches, they don't have that kind of access. And we were in existence for a good year and a half, and people didn't even know we existed. And a number of women would write to Synod, when are you going to do something about women. And the president would write back and carbon us. And I would send copies of all of the articles about what we were doing and what our assignments were that had appeared in Alive and the Reporter. But women had never seen those because they are not involved in areas that receive that mail. So that's an important point, and one we want to try to do something. The Bible study went through doctrinal review, but the report did not. And we all have one-way tickets to South America. Yeah. No, it's on its way. It really, the target date for having it in hand, in color, in place, ready to use is May 20th. But I expect it'll be a couple of days more. But it is really done. Mm-hmm. The report is different from anything that's been done because this was the first time that all of this data about women have been put together in one place. We have a listing of every synodical resolution that relates to women. We have all of the areas women are serving in and the numbers. We have so much in this report that it can provide a resource for the whole church, and it has never existed before. So it is different, and that's one of the reasons it took a long while. There are sections you're going to go, you know, because it is just repeating information. But in terms of providing the church with a comprehensive accounting of the history of women in the Missouri Synod, that will prove to be a good resource. The Bible study, we have tried. We've field tested it. We've bounced it off a variety of people, and we're very excited about it, and that has been the response we've had from everybody. So we're looking forward to that getting out into the church.
The question was, how does someone find a confidant within the congregation or in the area? I presume it wouldn't have to be the congregation, but a female confidant.
It gets awfully lonesome if your husband is the only person you can confide in. He won't always understand everything anyway, because he's man and you're woman, and we don't always talk the same languages, you know. So you really do need somebody who is your confidant, I suppose. And I don't see anything wrong with, you will find when you're in the parish that you like some people better than others, and you're more drawn to some than others. I guess the main thing is to be fair, you know, not to always be with one person all the time. But I see no reason why you can't have friends.
You must be careful about having close friends in the congregation. Sometimes you have them and then something happens and they turn on you. And then everything you have told them is soon become public. I was at a pastor's wise meeting many years ago. And one of the pastor there said that when you get down and when you're lonely, you pick up that phone and you make a long distance phone call to maybe another semwife that you were close to, or a sister or a mother or whatever. But you must, you know, you must talk it over with your husband. But this is something that maybe would work for you. And your husband should have the same privilege. He also needs a buddy, and he should maybe pick up the phone sometime and call one of somebody who he was friendly with here at the seminary. Or, you know, or maybe there would be a pastor's wife in the circuit that you would feel close to. But think about that. And you must, you know, if you're going to have, you're either going to pay Ma Bell or you're going to pay the doctor. You know, and discuss that with him, because you should have the privilege, and so should he, of picking up that phone if it's 2:00 in the afternoon, and you need to talk to someone. If it is a half an hour, so it's a half an hour. But I would say be very careful about friends and congregation, because many times it, what should I say, backfires on you. I don't know if that was helpful or not.
Again, this isn't from the perspective of being a pastor's wife, but I would encourage you to keep your eyes and ears and heart and mind open to women that you are in contact with on a daily basis, and pick one or two and perhaps initiate with them beginning a weekly Bible and prayer group. And it may not have to be women in the parish. I mean, that's something that I'll defer to the pastor's wives to talk about. But it might be someone in your child's play group. It might be another minister's wife from another church. But when you get into the Word and when you pray for one another, the Holy Spirit becomes your confidant, really. But it's really nice to have a woman friend to do that with. And so that would be my suggestion, just as someone who has just moved to a new area and had that question for myself.
Well, I wish we could go on and on and on, but I know some of you have little ones that probably are going, it's time for me to go to bed. Where's Mom? But I want to invite you all to stay. We have some goodies at either end of the room for each of you, all of you to partake of, and I think our panelists will be available to answer questions or to mingle around and be with all of you. We've been fortunate to have audiovisual tape the meeting tonight, so if any of you would like to have it on tape, you can request it at the library.